good morning. Before we get started, I understand there's an issue with respect to the visual aids. So why don't we take that up first? So let me recap sort of information I have so far. My understanding is that yesterday, Alan Murakami, counsel for the plaintiff appellants, called the court to see if he could borrow the equipment to present visual aids. I think we said okay, but he was told that he needs to get court approval before he can use that, and was directed to call the chief judge's office. A member of my staff talked to him. He explained that he wanted to use a PowerPoint that would show references to the record citations and things in the record, and was told, well, you should talk to the other side and see what their position is. And later that day, a staff attorney talked to Mr. Murakami and was told that one of the Hawaiian Homes Commission lawyer objected and that the state lawyer couldn't be contacted. So that's where we left off yesterday. So is there a request by the appellant to use the visual aids?
Yes, Your
Honor. Why don't you, and is there objection on the other side?
We also objected. We had sent an email to Mr. Murakami before closing
business. All right, I think for recording purposes, we need to use the microphone. All right, so why don't you make your argument as to your request for the visual aid.
Your Honor, it's quite simple. We'd like to use these images, which are quotations, which are from the record. We're prepared to go either way. It's not the end of the world if you deny the motion, but on the other hand, we don't see a basis to object either.
All right, and then objections by the appellees?
Yes, the state objected primarily because by only putting in selected excerpts from the constitutional history, you're presenting a misleading picture, and without everything there before the court, it would be a slanted picture of what the constitutional convention history shows.
Do you have any objection that the materials that are being proffered are not part of the record, or not things that could be argued before the court?
No, I don't.
All right. Counsel for Hawaiian Homes Commission.
Your Honor, we had a similar objection in the sense that it was selective excerpts of the record, which did not fairly present, you know, other aspects of the record we felt were important. We got the call at about 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon, and the additional basis was we did not feel it was fair, given the timing, we did not have an opportunity to also prepare excerpts of the record to illustrate our points on that.
Do you have any objection that the materials being proffered are not part of the record or inappropriate?
No, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you.
Based upon those arguments, I'm going to grant the request to use the visual aids. You need any time to set up, or are you ready to proceed right now? All right. Please proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm David Frankel here with Alan Murakami on behalf of plaintiffs, beneficiaries of the Hawaiian Homelands Trust. I'd like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. The story of the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act is a story of broken promises and delay. As Prince Kohio explained, Hawaiian homelands were set aside as a matter of justice, belated justice, to those Hawaiians who did not receive but were supposed to receive land from the mahele. As a condition of statehood, the newly formed state entered into a solemn compact with the United States, accepting the duties and obligations of a trustee. Delegates to the 1978 Constitutional Convention, however, explicitly acknowledged that the state had done a shameful job of fulfilling its obligations to Native Hawaiians. One delegate summarized, "The Hawaiian Homes Department and Act were and are the most neglected part of the state of Hawaii, the most neglected department. It was woefully lacking in funding in funds at its inceptions and for the past 50 years and even today. It lacks funds to run the department properly, lacks funds to construct homes and facilities necessary to service existing and future applicants." In Baker v. Carr, the preeminent political question doctrine case, the U.S. Supreme Court emphasized the necessity for discriminating inquiry into the precise facts and posture of the particular case. So I'd like to take 2 minutes summarizing the specific, concrete, precise facts of this case. In 3 decades, the Hawaiian Homes wait list has quadrupled. Over 1,600 Native Hawaiians have been on the wait list for over 3 decades. Over 8,000 have waited over 2 decades. More people are added to the wait list each year than the number of homestead leases that are awarded. The Hawaiian Homes Commission chair estimates the department needs $100 million annually. Yet last year, the legislature removed all general revenue funding for the department's administrative and operating expenses. The department is forced to lease Hawaiian homelands for the sole purpose of raising revenue. In DHHL's newsletter, the commission chair wrote, "Revenue generation is the cornerstone of fulfilling our mission." The same newsletter discusses the need to generate significant non-governmental revenue in order to provide greater financial support towards fulfilling our mission to develop and deliver lands to Native Hawaiians. Without money or infrastructure, either the price of new homes will increase by an average of $100,000, or the department will not be able to build as many homes as is needed.
Council, it seems to me that the crux of the legal issue on appeal is the question of whether the constitutional provision, which calls for the appropriation of sufficient sums, provides a manageable standard that the court can apply. What's your argument as to whether or not sufficient sums provides a manageable standard?
The Hawaii Supreme Court has articulated over and over and over again that when it comes to constitutional provisions, we need to look at the intent of the framers. We need to look at the intent of the framers to discover whether there are manageable standards, whether it is a nebulous term. We have to look at that intent. So that's the beginning point. What was their intent? Well, if you read the...
Can I stop you first? Can I ask you a preliminary question? If we don't look at the intent of the delegates and just looked at the language of the constitutional provision, would you concede or would you disagree that that provision on its face is that there's no manageable standards by which the court could determine what sufficient sums is just based upon that provision itself?
We would not concede that point. I think there's a few things to realize. Sufficient sums obviously is more than zero. It cannot be zero. Now, I would emphasize by looking at the legislative history, but if we're going to ignore that, clearly the word in the Constitution was changed from may to shall. So there's an obligation to provide something. This past year, the legislature provided no general revenue funding to the Department of Hawaiian Homelands for its administrative and operating expenses, which is one of the four areas that are listed in the constitutional amendment. So no, I think there are clear, manageable standards on the face.
What are they, in other words? How would we frame that in terms of articulating a standard? Would it be by number of house lots provided each year? Would it be by reduction of the waiting list? Would it be by a level of appropriation? What would the standard that the court would look to in trying to fulfill or enforce that constitutional provision?
I would say there's four things you need to look at, and I'll just list them off and then go through each one. The four things are that you need to have more than zero funding. You have to look at the state's admission. You need to look at the growth of the wait list, and you need to look at the fact that DHHL is leasing its homelands to raise revenue. So the first one, zero funding. The legislature has provided no general revenue funding this past year for the administrative and operating budget of the Department of Hawaiian Homelands. Yet the Constitution says, shall make sufficient sums for the administration and operating budget of the Department of Hawaiian Homelands. Clearly, you can't administer the money with zero money. There are, I think we've cited three cases to you from mainland jurisdictions in which the courts have held, and I'm talking not in an educational context, in which the courts have said, hey, you need to provide basic levels of funding for things for which the legislature has no discretion. You've got to provide that. And clearly, zero funding is insufficient. So that's one thing. The second thing is we have the state admitting in its budget documents submitted to the legislature that the major obstacle to putting more Hawaiians on the land is the lack of sufficient funding for infrastructure development. Now, when you have an admission by the state, by the opposing party, there's no difficult inquiry you need to go through. There's no standards you need to search for because the state's admitted it. They have said all they have admitted is the obvious.
All right, so your position, as I understand it, is you want the court to say that we don't have to determine what sufficient sums is. We can just say whatever that level is, the current level is insufficient.
That's correct.
Now, if we did that, how would one of the reliefs you're asking for is injunctive relief to require the state to comply with the constitutional provision? How would we decide whether or not the state complied unless we can articulate what sufficient sums is?
I've got several answers to that. First of all, at this stage, we are not asking you for injunctive relief. I think this matter would then be remanded to the circuit court. And in fact, in Baker v. Carr, the U.S. Supreme Court specifically noted that it was the district court there that was more in a better position to frame the appropriate relief. I forgot what all my other answers were.
Let me ask you a question in terms of, I think sufficient sums is sufficiently ambiguous. You have to look at the constitutional history, the committee report, the journal, and then extract from that intent whether or not there's manageable standards. The other thing I haven't heard, and I know members of the Department of Hawaiian Homelands are defendants in this suit, would seem to me you would be looking at the request for sufficient sums or the request for funding of the Department of Hawaiian Homelands, and that under Ohuna versus Department of Hawaiian Homelands, they have a fiduciary duty to make a reasonable request for sufficient funds. If you look at the journal, they're talking about master plans. There should be a master plan of some sort, and request for funds should be based on that in carrying out, and the legislature responds. They just don't appropriate funds without a response. And the court could look at this request, see if the request is reasonable, look at the legislative response, look at the standing committee report, look at the journal, and see if there is a reasonable request and reasonable response. Is that how a court could determine there's sufficient funds?
Yes, Your Honor. Let's begin with your beginning question, and that is the intent of the framers. If you look at the 1978 Constitutional Convention, I think there are six obvious themes. There are subtle differences, but there are six obvious themes that the delegates articulated over and over again. First, that so few Native Hawaiians were being placed on the land. Second, that it was taking so long to put them on the land. Third, that the legislature was not providing funding to the Department of Hawaiian Homelands. Fourth, that the legislature forced DHHL, unlike other state agencies, to raise its own funds for its administrative and operating expenses. Fifth, the department was being forced to lease homestead lands in order to raise revenues. And finally, that Hawaiian homelands that could be used for homesteading were instead being leased to others.
Let me ask you this. Okay, so assuming based upon the legislative history, we can interpret the phrase sufficient sums to mean that the delegates felt that the current level of funding in 1978 was insufficient, so it's got to be above that. How do we determine what sufficient is above that? In other words, what do we look for? What standards can we apply to say, assuming we find that the floor is set by what was being funded in 78 or the progress being made in 78, how do we then determine whether the constitutional provision, sufficient sums requirement, is being complied with? What standards do we look at?
So there are four that I'll articulate. Let me address two that I have not articulated yet. One standard is if DHHL is being forced to lease its lands. The committee report for this constitutional amendment says, it is clear to your committee that the intent and spirit of the act would be better served by releasing the department of its present burden to generate revenues through the general leasing of its land. Your committee decided that through legislative funding, this dilemma would be resolved. In that manner, more lands could be made available to the intended beneficiaries. The department,
So what does that mean? Does that mean that your position is that the department cannot lease any lands for revenue purposes to the general public?
It's more subtle than that. It is that if the department is leasing its land to raise revenues, that is compelling evidence that DHHL is not receiving sufficient funds from the legislature. And in fact, if you read their summer 2007 newsletter, they say Revenue generation is the cornerstone of fulfilling our mission. We've committed ourselves to increasing revenue from all sources, and especially through our commercial properties. What's the reason? They say that they don't want to depend on the vagaries of the political process, which, yeah, is understandable, but the legislature is supposed to provide the funding. And if they are forced, if DHHL is forced to lease homelands to raise revenues, that is overwhelming evidence that they're not getting sufficient funds to fulfill their mission.
All right. So say the department is leasing certain amount of lands. How do we then determine, based upon sufficient sums, whether that's appropriate or inappropriate? In other words, you're asking us to be able to say at a certain level of, you're not saying that all leasing is prohibited, but you're saying that there's a certain level at which, given the constitutional provision, it would be in violation. My question is, where is that level, and how do we go about determining what that level is?
My first answer is, you're not being asked in this case to determine that level. We're presenting the concrete facts of today, and today it is clear that they're not. They have instituted a program where they are leasing Hawaiian home lands commercially in order to raise revenue because they're not getting the money from the legislature. So, end of debate, right there.
But counsel, do the facts matter? I mean, what we're reviewing is a lower court ruling that the question of what are sufficient sums is a political question. It's not dealing with the specific allegations of the complaint. They're not, the lower court's not looking at your complaint. It doesn't matter whether there's been sufficient sums or not at this stage. The question is, can the court inquire whether there's sufficient sums given the language of that constitutional provision, given the standing committee report in the journal, given the Baker v. Carr test as adopted by Yamasaki? Isn't that solely it? It's a legal question, whether it's a political question or not, regardless of the facts.
I disagree, Your Honor. In Baker v. Carr, the U.S. Supreme Court said very clearly and emphasized the necessity for discriminating inquiry into the precise facts of the particular case. You cannot separate this case from the facts. And what the defendants have attempted to do is shift this whole legal case into another realm of abstract hypotheticals. We're not bringing an abstract hypothetical case to you. We're bringing a case with specific facts, a case in controversy.
Let me ask you a question. If the way I understand your analysis is that there's two parts to it. In sufficient sums is composed of two parts. One is, if you can say that it's clearly insufficient, then you haven't met the sufficient sums requirement. And then there's a question is, when you get close to that, how to determine it. So is your analysis that it's not a political question in terms of if the level of funding is clearly below sufficient, then it's not a political question, but it may be a political question when you get close to above that floor? I mean, in other words, it's a two-part analysis, and we're still in the first part because your argument is, given the facts of the case, By any reasonable argument, the level of funding is insufficient?
I believe it's footnote 48 in Baker v. Carr, in which the U.S. Supreme Court articulates what you just said, that there are cases in which it is so egregious that the political question in terms of the standards, the clearly measurable standards, does not come into play.
And do you think that's this case?
That is clearly this case. We are not going to concede that there will be times when it will be a political question. If you look at the education cases that we've cited, I think there's about 17 or 18 cases across the country, and in the cases we cite, the courts say no political question doctrine, and then they go on, and in some cases they find, oh no, the state's providing adequate levels of funding for education, and in other cases they say no, it's not adequate, and sometimes they say, you know what, this is a gray area, reasonable people may differ, we're not going to get involved, it's a legislature's call. This court does not need to address that issue today. The only issue is the case as we've presented it to you, given these facts. And given these facts, the level of funding has not been and is not sufficient.
Oh, right, but if, so in other words, you're saying there's a floor, the floor, and then there's sufficient sums up here, but there's clearly a level below which everyone would agree it's insufficient. And I take it your argument is that right now we're below that floor.
Yes.
Now, assuming that the 78th Amendment and the Constitutional Convention established that floor, what are the standards that we would apply to say what that floor is?
Again, I would point to four things. Number one, if DHHL is in a position where it's forced to lease homestead lands for, to raise revenue, if they're leasing it for other purposes, then that question is triggered. But here, in this case, we have clear admissions that that's why they're leasing the land, to raise revenue, because they're not getting it from the legislature, then...
But to raise revenue for what, though? I mean, is the department has... For administrative expenses or for in general? I mean, it's...
Well...
They're different funding sources, so it's difficult for... Which, to, in some senses, are fungible, so it's hard... I mean, just to say that they're raising it for revenue, it seems to me that it's, in itself is a kind of a vague... standard or reference.
I disagree, Your Honor. That's because of the language of Article 12, Section 1. The sufficient sums that are supposed to be made available for four significant purposes, which is the entire purpose of the Hawaiian Homes Commission, which is the development of home, agriculture, farm, and ranch lots. That's huge. Two, home, agriculture, aquaculture, farm, and ranch loans. Three, rehabilitation projects to include but not limited to educational, economic, political, social, and cultural processes by which the general welfare and conditions of Native Hawaiians are thereby improved, and fourth, the administration and operating budget of the Department of Hawaiian Homelands. So the revenue that they are raising now is for these four purposes. They're not going to say it's for anything else because that's what they're supposed to be doing. That's what they don't have sufficient sums from the legislature for. But to continue answering your question, that's only one of the criteria. Another criteria is the wait list growing? We know that the wait list has quadrupled since 1978. Yet the whole purpose of the constitutional amendment was to put Hawaiians on the land. If the wait list is growing, if more people are added than leases are being awarded, there's clear evidence that insufficient sums are being provided, that the intent of the framers is not being met.
Is that specific in the legislative history or the Constitutional Convention history that one of the criteria that the delegates referred to was reducing or not increasing the amount of people on the wait list?
Let me point to two sources. The committee report in which they say, your committee decided that through legislative funding this dilemma would be resolved. In that manner, more lands could be made available to the intended beneficiaries. Another delegate says, and to the world sufficient. What does that really mean? It means funding to develop house lots for applicants on the waiting list or implied in the general plan. I see my time is up, but that's clearly there. Thank you.
Can you shut the visual aid off, please?
Good morning. Good morning, Your Honors. Plaintiffs in this suit are making the most extraordinary request of the judiciary. They are asking the judicial branch to usurp the legislature's traditional prerogative of appropriating money to state departments and order the legislature to appropriate a particular amount of money to the Department of Hawaiian Homelands based on nothing more than their personal opinion of what is an appropriate amount.
Counsel, can I ask you there, what does the phrase no discretion mean when it refers to the legislature and the standing committee report? The convention was very clear that the legislature would have no discretion in this matter. Doesn't mean what they do is reviewable, because if it's not, they have absolute discretion.
What I think it means is that the legislature shall provide sufficient sums. The problem is because...
And if they don't?
The problem here is that there's no way to define, because of the terms and the way the provision is structured,
then
sufficient
the
sums to do what?
The provision is meaningless. The 78 convention proposed and the people adopted an amendment to the Constitution that means nothing as a practical matter. Isn't that the case, your argument?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. It's our position that what the provision does is it provides a moral basis and a sense of duty on the part of the legislature to provide more funds than they otherwise would.
And that's what the convention was proposing, a moral duty to the legislature and not sufficient funds? Isn't that how it's worked out?
I'm sorry?
I mean, is that what the convention was trying to do, give the legislature a sense of moral duty, not legal duty?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, I think that is basically what they were doing by imposing a provision that did not have well-defined characteristics so that one could quantify what the obligation was. In effect, they yielded nothing more than that, because it was impossible for a court of law to provide the specificities needed to
make. What if they said on the face of the constitutional provision, sufficient sums can be reviewed by the court? They could do that, couldn't they?
They certainly could.
And if the intent expresses the same, don't they accomplish the same? If that's
yes.
What no discretion means?
Yes, but the problem is, in this case, when you try to, even if you assume no discretion means they must do this, and that's not, on our basis of our argument is not to necessarily refute that. Our point is that when you say they must do that, the question then becomes, must do what? And because there's no way to quantify the what, that is, in this case, there's no way to say how many homesteads must be provided each year or whether there's a maximum waiting period time that is allowable.
Well, but your analysis is basically that provision is unenforceable.
Correct, because of the political question doctrine.
It really, other than a moral duty, it poses no obligation that can be enforced on the legislature, on the executive branch, or on the judiciary.
Yes, and that is the essence of what happens when you have the political question doctrine.
You're telling us, given the Standing Committee report, the journal, that the delegates were absolutely incensed on the history of the Department of Hawaiian Homelands, and that they did not intend to have a legally enforceable duty to carry out their intent, their will, to provide sufficient sums. All they were doing is just telling the legislature, geez, you're morally responsible. That's it? That's your argument?
Two things. I would argue, yes, that in fact they were intending a moral duty and to basically convince the legislature to do more and give more than they were intending. But even if we assume they intended an actual enforceable duty, because they did not provide standards or judicially ascertainable or manageable standards in the constitutional provision itself or in the constitutional convention history, it becomes impossible for the court to judicially enforce that.
Your view appears to be it's all or nothing, because we can't determine with particularity what sufficient sums is, because there's nothing in the history that says how many homes a year have to be distributed or how quickly the wait list has to be taken care of, that we can't enforce any of it. But isn't it clear from the legislative history of the convention that at minimum the delegates were dissatisfied with the levels of funding and the progress that was being made in 1978. That's why they changed it from a discretionary, the legislature may appropriate sums, to the legislature shall appropriate sufficient sums, correct?
Yes.
So wouldn't that be a manageable standard? In other words, at minimum, there's a floor that we can establish based upon a relative comparison with the situation in 1978 and argue that if it's worse than that or the funding is not comparable to that, it's got to be insufficient pursuant to the motivation for or the legislative history for that provision.
I would have three responses. First of all, the legislative history doesn't make clear that there's a floor based on what is going on at that point. And that's particularly true when you consider that economic situations vary from time to time. Here we are 30 years later in the midst of a massive financial economic crisis. And so even if the amounts they were not satisfied with in 1978 weren't enough, when you have an economic crisis as we do now, you know, one cannot assume that therefore the standard is set in stone based on what happens 32 years ago.
Well, why not though? Because you concede that if, for example, the Constitution read you have to provide 1,000 new homes to people on the wait list every year, that would be an enforceable provision.
Absolutely.
Regardless of whether the economic conditions are good, bad, or otherwise.
Absolutely correct. And if this case involved a constitutional provision that had a constitutional provision that specified you shall provide enough sufficient funds to produce 1,000 homesteads a year, then plaintiffs would have a non-frivolous case.
Why can't we read what the delegates did as saying you got to do better? We're not satisfied with what's happening now. You at least have to do better than what you did and use that as at least a floor to establish manageable, determinable standard by which to compare the current performance.
Again, I guess you have to judge performance based on the kind of the financial situation you're in. If the financial situation deteriorates, I don't think the convention would expect you to do better when the financial situation deteriorates. But putting that aside, let's assume that they did have a floor. The delegate Antai, which is part of their PowerPoint production, specifically mentions that, you know, he's not satisfied, and he mentions that they produce 50 homesteads a year. In fact, what we're doing now is producing under the Department of Hawaiian Homelands budget 210 a year, another 51 for released out surrender claims, so you have 261 a year. So we are doing better in this case. So even if you were to assume there was a floor, we've certainly met that and surpassed that floor. And Your Honor mentions that, made a distinction between whether we're just talking about not being able to come up with a manageable standard to specify the specific amount, or whether or not we're just saying somehow this is beneath a low floor, somehow beyond the pale. And in this case, I don't think this court can possibly conclude that what's going on right now is beyond the pale for two reasons. They are producing 210 plus 51 or 261 a year. There's nothing in the legislative history to suggest that that is not sufficient.
But that would take it out of a political question. In other words, if you agreed that that the convention set at least a floor, that would be a manageable standard that the trial court could, based upon evidentiary or facts presented, could make a determination whether or not the state had been complied.
Yeah, no,
it would be a political question that they couldn't even address the merits of.
Yeah, well, see, I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, if you're going to try to come up with the exact amount that's necessary, then that's clearly a political question. But what they're trying to say is, well, you don't have to come up with the number because this is just so far beyond the pale.
Right.
And so what I'm trying to say is that given that they produce 261 homesteads a year, you can't say this is beyond the pale.
Are you talking about exact amount under Baker v. Carr and apportionment? Isn't close enough good enough?
Close enough could be good enough. And in this case, they certainly can't say that no one can say that the Department of Hawaiian Homelands is not close enough to producing whatever level of funding.
Well, what I'm talking about is sufficient sums. I mean, the whole test that Yamasaki adopted was from Baker v. Carr, which was the apportionment cases, right?
Right.
And what the courts did was basically allow the legislature, once it was determined it wasn't apportioned, to bring forth one man, one vote, take another shot at reapportioning, and then the court would examine that. They wouldn't go in and apportion the legislature unless the legislature refused to do it. And we're not talking about something exact, close enough. I mean, it's not exact when you get one man.
Right, and our simple point is that they can't establish any level of funding that is necessarily or sufficient, and certainly they can't establish that the level of funding that is going on right now is below some floor.
So they don't have to provide any.
What's that?
So they don't have to provide any. That's your argument.
Well,
because it's unreviewable.
Our point is that in this particular case, they are providing something. It is very misleading.
But your legal argument, if they provide nothing, that still is unreviewable because it's a political question. Isn't that your argument?
Yes, but we're not dependent upon that argument alone, because even if you were to reject that argument and say that, well, the state's got to do something, it's got to be somewhere beyond the pale, otherwise you're clearly beyond the bounds of any reasonableness.
Right,
our point is that we're not there.
But analytically, say for 10 years the legislature provided zero funding and provided no new homes, wouldn't we be able with comfort to say, okay, well, whatever the exact standard is, that's got to be insufficient funds, and so the state is violating their obligation under the Constitution. And I mean, analytically,
yeah, that's perhaps possible.
Right, so that's not a political question then. In other words, there is a deficiency such that we can, through manageable standards, say you're not complying with the Constitution.
Yes, and I think that's the case in all situations, because when you have provisions that have political question problems, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a political question with respect to all aspects of it. There can always be some things that clearly fall within the realm of that statute. It's just that when you get onto the border areas, and in this case way beyond the border areas, that's where you can at least say there is a political question problem. And I think it's important to point out that unlike the picture that they're trying to paint, where we're giving nothing, in fact, the legislature for the fiscal 2010-2011 years has provided $11 million in general obligation bond funding. And so it's just wrong for them to say that somehow the Department of Hawaiian Homelands or the state is neglecting the department. In fact, when you look at the overall budget for the Department of Hawaiian Homelands, they're receiving over $160 million for the two-year period. Even putting aside revenue bonds, they're receiving $100 million. Much of it is federal funding, some of it's GO bond funding. And so to suggest that somehow the department or the state is going beyond the pale and not giving them any money is just ridiculous when you consider the fact that they're getting $100 million.
Does the Department of Hawaiian Homelands have a fiduciary duty to make a reasonable request for sufficient sums?
I think they do, but the question—
Is that reviewable?
Well, that's an issue of a breach of fiduciary duty, and what they're claiming in this case is Article 12, Section 1, sufficient sums provision.
Just my question. Is it reviewable? Can we review the request to the legislature by the Department of Hawaiian Homelands, whether they're carrying out their fiduciary duty to the beneficiary?
Sure. But in this case, I don't think that there's any basis for concluding that they've somehow acted beyond their fiduciary duties when they've provided over $100 million for the next two fiscal years. So the suggestion that they're somehow
a breach. And if the department is carrying out its fiduciary duty and making a reasonable request to the legislature, doesn't that help a court review whether the legislature is appropriating sufficient sums? Because you have this fiduciary duty being carried out.
Well, I don't think the legislature is obligated to provide whatever funding the Department of Homeland requests.
I didn't say that. I mean, it's a measurement. If the request is too low, the legislature should provide more. But at least it's something to look at. I mean, in the Ahuna case, clearly, the Supreme Court said we can review, you know, acts of the trustees, fiduciary duty, whether they're acting reasonably. You say that's not a political question. Certainly it's a standard of measurement in terms of what the legislature is responding to, what the department's basing its request on.
Well, if we're going to look at what the request was, then in fact the director, Mike Akane, had actually requested total self-sufficiency, in which case clearly the legislature has gone beyond that in providing actual general obligation bond funding.
But you're basically saying we can review his request. That doesn't mean we have to accept his request as reasonable, do we?
Certainly not. But again, we see no basis for understanding or comprehending why that particular request would be deemed inadequate. I mean, budget requests is just a political
process. I'm not looking at a particular request. I'm just basically getting you to concede that's not a political question.
Whether the Department of Hawaiian Homelands is in breach of a fiduciary duty based on what they asked for is not a political question.
Thank you.
But the issue in this case is whether or not Article 12, Section 1, sufficient sums clause provides any obligation on the part of the legislature to provide a particular amount of money.
Let me ask this question. One of the arguments that you make is that it's a political question because it would require the court to get entangled in policy decisions that are non-judicial questions. How do you define what questions are questions, policy questions that are not for the court? I want to see what the guidelines for that are, because the court often does engage in policy determination. So what areas are you saying is such in this case that we cannot get into?
I mean, I think it's hard to come up with a description in words of how to draw the line. I think the best way would be to look at some examples. In this case, to decide whether or not everyone that's on a wait list and even needs to get on to a homestead, you have to look to what the goal of the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act was, which is to rehabilitate Native Hawaiians. And one would have to make a policy determination as to whether or not everyone on the wait list needs rehabilitation, and that, you know, if people already have a home, have sufficient living circumstances, have high income or assets, whether they even need a homestead to be rehabilitated. That's a policy question. Now, some would argue that they still need
a question that the court is ill-equipped or improperly, it would be improper for the court to make a call on that.
It's because it's a question that the court would have to think, well, does someone who has a home and has sufficient income and assets, do they really need a home to become rehabilitated? I think that's a question that really can't be answered. It depends on a policy and a values-based view.
Mr. Lau, I think when I was doing years ago prison litigation, you may have been involved, and the 13th Amendment and the state counterpart prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. That's all it says. And I think you're aware of the sort of federal litigation that went on and the very detailed consent decrees that were dealing with the type of health care, dental care, dentistry, programs, rec hours. These were decisions courts were making from the phrase cruel and unusual punishment. Isn't that some sort of a policy determination?
Well, certainly, I think in the general constitutional law area, like involving the Bill of Rights, you have a whole history of judicial decisions that have essentially given a sort of specificity and have articulated standards so that those otherwise arguably vague phrases can be made meaningful.
That didn't start until the 70s, 1970s. There was no litigation until the 70s. One court had to go first.
Right. I just think in this particular case, when you're dealing with a provision that says you shall provide sufficient sums to develop lots, and you give no indication as to how many lots, how quickly people must get onto the wait list, when you have this massive program of thousands of people who want a particular benefit, and you have to decide what is rehabilitation, what is needed for rehabilitation, who needs rehabilitation, does someone with a lot of money need rehabilitation, can someone with a home, an existing home, do fine without a homestead and still be essentially rehabilitated? I think those are the kinds of questions that you really need to have the Constitutional Convention articulate, either through specific words or with detailed legislative Constitutional Convention history. We simply don't have this here. This court, in order to answer this question, would simply be deciding on its own, based on its own values, whether or not, you know, these people need to be put on within a certain amount of time. The plaintiffs here are simply pulling the figure 10 years out of a hat. There's nothing in the history or the language of the provision to give us any guidance as to what level or what maximum waiting period time is acceptable. And when you have such a wide open thing.
The aspect of the logic of your analysis is that, so the legislature and the state don't have to do anything, and the courts can't do anything to enforce the constitutional provision. I mean, that seems to me to be a very troublesome analysis in terms of your logic. So is there an intermediate ground?
Well,
is there an intermediate ground to say we can do something?
I think
so insufficient, we can say, hey, that's no good. You got to do at least better than some level.
Well, I would say two things. One, when the political question doctrine is invoked, that is the necessary consequence, that the provision becomes judicially unenforceable. But even if one were to say, well, this provision could at least be enforceable if you went way beyond the pale. So even if we were to assume, for the sake of argument, that providing, as you gave in your hypothetical, giving no homesteads at all, getting no money for the department, that was somehow beyond the pale, fine. You can bring a case, perhaps in that case, let's assume. But in this case, we're nowhere near that. We're producing 210 homes. We're giving them over $50 million a year. And so we're just so far beyond that we don't even have to worry about coming up to that, the harder question of what would be the specific amount necessary.
You're basically saying you can be a little bit pregnant. I mean, there are judicial manageable standards to say, you know, it's not enough, but there's no standards to determine what's enough.
Well, our whole point is that there is no standards to determine what's enough. And their position is that, well, you don't have to determine exactly what's enough. You just have to determine that what's being done right now is beyond the pale, is somehow clearly not enough. And we're saying that given that they're producing 260 homes a year and getting $50 million
dollars
a year.
No, question, are you telling him the courts can enter it to some degree, but
well, again, our position is not at all. But even
so
if we
then
were
you're saying no to his question.
Yes, but assuming if the court were to reject that position and say, well, there is still some little level that we can say is beyond the pale, we're not there in this case. And that's our whole point here, is that we're certainly not there in this case. So at the very least,
but if we were in that case, could we go there as a court?
Yeah.
So then that's not a political question. It's the funding.
Well, again, it's our position that you're nowhere near there. You're nowhere near there, and therefore, there's no reason for this court to delve into that particular question because we're nowhere near there. And so
did the lower court made no findings of fact, did it? Didn't it just, in a sort of perfunctory manner, just dismiss it? No manageable standards?
Correct. And I think that was the correct ruling. And that's implicit in that ruling.
So they didn't rule that we're nowhere near there, did they?
I think implicitly that is essentially what they did, because they were certainly arguing to the contrary.
Well, if they adopted your argument, they wouldn't have to get there. You just said it's unreviewable. I mean, you're only making this argument in response to Nakamura's question. Well, if the court were to do this, then we would look at that. But your initial argument, it's unreviewable at any level, right?
Yes.
Isn't that the argument you made in the lower court?
Yes. I mean,
and couldn't that, the way we read the order, they adopted your argument in the lower court?
Yes, but in order to reverse them, and if you wanted to take the position that no, it could be reviewable at some level, then you'd have to conclude that somehow they've established that we're beyond the pale, and they haven't done that given the 260 leases and the $50 million a year. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, members of the court. Brian Kang appearing on behalf of the Department of Hawaiian Homelands appellees. This court should affirm the circuit court's order granting the department's joinder in the motion for summary judgment under the political question doctrine. No one in this room would argue that the history of the Hawaiian Homelands program is without significant controversy. No one in this room would argue that the history of the program is without many grave concerns raised by many people. Yet, regardless of one's view of the past history of the program, this court is not called upon today to address all the wrongs of the past. From DHHL's perspective, this case goes to the heart of its ability and its duty to oversee and control its own policies, goals, and priorities for the best long-term interests of its beneficiaries. DHHL is concerned about the policy and practical impact of the appellant's efforts to have the judicial branch interpret the language of Article 12 on DHHL's ability to carry out its mandate under the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act. That's because one cannot make a determination of what funding is sufficient or insufficient for the Hawaiian Homelands Program under Article 12.
Can the department make a determination what are sufficient funds, regardless of what the legislature thinks?
Your Honor,
are they duty-bound to do so?
Your Honor, yes.
We can review that, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
We can review that, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. This court can review that, and in fact, the record reflects that the department has indicated that it believes it has requested and received sufficient sums to make incremental progress on its stated goals in its current strategic plan.
But your analysis, we can review it, but we can't ever say the department was wrong because we can't tell what the measurable standard is.
Well, Your Honor, what we're saying is that this court cannot say using Article 12, the language in Article 12, sufficient sums, and evaluate it based on the language of Article 12. That's what we're saying. And I think the members of the court are also indicating that,
How would we determine whether or not the department violated its fiduciary duty by failing to request sufficient sums when it went to the legislature?
Well, I think in that case, Your Honor, it would be under AHUNA. It would be the standards articulated under AHUNA. It would be standards articulated under trust law, et cetera. But our position is that using the language of Article 12 is a political question, and this court should not use Article 12 because it is a political question and is not reviewable by this court.
So how does the department determine what are sufficient sums when it makes its request?
It has to consider a whole host of policy issues, Your Honor, and I think, you know, some of those I think are reflected in the record. It would depend, for example, on whether the department wishes or based on the interests of the beneficiaries, construct homesteads in master plan communities versus individual homesteads. What are the wishes of the beneficiaries as to where those homesteads are located? What is the existing infrastructure, if any? If not, what is the timing of that infrastructure, et cetera? So there are a host of policy issues that the department needs to consider in formulating its request to the legislature and what it believes is sufficient to accomplish those goals within the context of other funding as well. And that's also a policy issue. If the department, as is its stated goal, wishes to become self-sufficient, that is a policy issue that then translates into what types of funding the department seeks from other areas, from the legislature, from the federal government, from leases of Hawaiian homelands, et cetera. So our position, Your Honor, is that there are policy issues that the department needs to consider, and that this court, using Article 12, cannot or should not delve into those policy issues.
So what was the effect of the 1978 constitutional amendment, where it said the legislature has no discretion, shall provide sufficient sums? What was its effect?
I think its effect, Your Honor, was to tell the legislature, and again, this is the legislature shall provide sufficient sums, was to tell the legislature that there is a genuine concern about the status of this program and that the legislature should pay attention and they should provide sums to the department.
And what does no discretion mean?
No discretion, Your Honor, means that the legislature shall provide sums.
And if it's unreviewable, it means they have absolute discretion. Isn't that the net effect?
Well, Your Honor, yes. It is the prerogative of the legislature under Article 12 to make a policy determination as to what sufficient sums would be our position, as well as the policy.
Basically, you're saying that the constitutional amendment accomplished nothing because it changed it from what was clearly discretionary with the legislature to something with no discretion, but you're saying because it's unenforceable, it really had no effect.
I'm not saying we're saying that it has no effect, Your Honor. I think it tells the legislature something that the Constitutional Convention delegates wanted the legislature to take action. So I don't think that's nothing. If I may describe it this way.
A Constitutional Convention can do more than urge somebody to do something, moral persuasion. They can legally mandate it. That's the supreme law.
That is the supreme
law. So they're not in a position sort of like begging the legislature, please, please do a better job. I mean, they can make them do it, correct?
I don't disagree with you, Your Honor. However, in this case, the language of Article 12 clearly does not provide judicially discoverable standards. And, you know, if the department...
And you don't think the intent was to make them do it?
I think the intent was to tell the legislature to fund the department.
But not to make it happen? The intent was not to make it happen? Because if it's unreviewable, there's no way to make it happen.
I think the intent may have been to try to make it happen. But, you know, the translated into the language that came out of Article 12, it does not provide standards within Article 12 itself. And the department's concern is that because it does not provide standards, we are going to be in a situation similar to some of the educational cases that we cited, the city of Pawtucket. We cited a Nebraska case in which courts have been involved in generations of litigation over constitutional amendments dealing with funding. And we do not believe it is in the best interest of the beneficiaries to be involved in litigation over questions of policy that the department should be making. And respectfully, the department believes it's in the best position to make those policy determinations. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
Let me respond to a couple things that were brought up, just to clarify a few things. The state talks about the 210 or 260 houses that DHHL has built or has provided. That's not actually what the record reflects. The record reflects part of a budget document projecting how many house lots or leases are projected to be awarded in the future. Furthermore, the record, which comes from DHHL, is that over the past few years, the number of people being added to the wait list were 762, 1,155, 775. So the number that are being added to the wait list is much greater than the number of homestead leases that are being awarded. But I think most importantly what's being neglected by the state is Act 14. Act 14 was enacted by the legislature to compensate the Department of Hawaiian Homelands for past breaches of the Hawaiian Homelands Trust. And so what's happening is DHHL is using that money to build lots for beneficiaries. But then they're saying, well, we're getting sufficient funds. But when they passed Act 14, the legislature wrote into the law, payments made under this act shall not diminish funds that the department is entitled to under Article 12, Section 1 of the Constitution of the State of Hawaii. They specifically provided that those monies shouldn't be double counted. After all, if those monies were considered today as meeting the state requirement for sufficient sums, they're not being compensated for past breaches. So it is inappropriate to talk about the number of houses that DHHL is building with money that's being provided to them for past egregious breaches of the trust.
Is the economic condition of the current economic condition of the state something that is relevant to whether sufficient sums are being appropriated under the Constitution?
No, Your Honor, it's not. Supreme Court of, I guess it's, I don't know if Alabama or Alaska, said it's a fundamental principle of constitutional law that constitutional obligations cannot be avoided because of a lack of funding. It's, that is not, the duty of this court is to interpret the Constitution. And again, what we've asked for is a declaration that they have not provided sufficient funding. I think it, you know, the economic condition of the state affects us all, affects the judiciary. But the Constitution is the foremost document we have, and we set priorities based on the Constitution. Well, that's where we're supposed to start.
Doesn't the court ultimately have to decide whether the funding is sufficient, and isn't that what the convention?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mandated?
Yes, Your Honor. And as you have pointed out, you know, the fact that the delegates said they are no longer affording the legislature discretion in this area is the key phrase. And that is why it is up to the judiciary to step in, as they always do.
But do you have a formula for us to apply? In other words, can you give us a formula that we can apply to convert a quantifiable measure to convert sufficient into something? Number of houses, reduce the waiting list, and relate that to something that is in the legislative history of the 78 amendment.
Yes, Your Honor, and I point to four things once again. It's more than zero. It's more than it's being provided now, given the state's admission. It's the wait list cannot be constantly growing, and it's where the Department of Homelands cannot be in a position where it's forced to lease its lands, Hawaiian homelands, to generate revenue. Those four things are, I don't know if formula is the right word, but they're the criteria by which this court can make that judgment. And those criteria are all found in the constitutional history. Delegate Higino says, shall mandates the legislature to fund the Department of Hawaiian Homelands. Delegate DeSoto says, without money, the Hawaiian Homes Department and program will fail miserably. Even opponents say this proposal is specific legislation and specifically requires the appropriation of money. Proponents and opponents of the amendment understood that it meant more than zero funding. The delegate explains, what does sufficient funding mean? It means funding to develop house lots for applicants on the wait list were applied in the general plan. And if the wait list is growing and growing and growing every year, that shows that the department isn't getting enough money to deal with its existing wait list. And the fact that, and I think this is probably clearest, where the department is being forced to lease homelands that could be used by beneficiaries in order to raise revenue. That was exactly the problem the CONCON delegates repeated over and over again. It's in their committee report.
Is there anything in the record that would provide a comparison between, relatively speaking, I know the inflation rate has changed from 78 to today, but that would compare the level of funding that was provided in 1978 in a comparative terms to what the level of funding is at the time of this lawsuit?
I believe that it is in the record, and I believe zero money was provided to the department in terms of general revenues at the time the constitutional amendment was passed. So clearly, it's got to be more than zero. But I don't know. I can't tell you what else is in the record.
Your position is general funding, the general funds appropriation is the only thing that counts. The bonds, everything, other revenue sources is something that the court should not consider in determining whether there's sufficient funds appropriated.
First of all, you should not count money that is raised through the leasing of Hawaiian homelands. That would be through revenue bonds. And monies in the special funds are all generated from the leasing of Hawaiian homelands, because that's exactly what the delegates were saying was not supposed to happen. So you can't look at that money. General obligation bonds that are given.
How much is that money? How much is that? How much is being raised from the general leasing of?
I don't think that's, Your Honor. I could give you a figure, but I don't think it's in the record.
Don't give it to me.
Yeah.
As far as
I recall.
Counsel, as far as standards, you know, I gave to Mr. Lau an example of prison litigation. You know, all you have is cruel and unusual punishment. You go to trial, people put on experts. States puts on experts. The other sides put on experts. They try to determine based on the evidence what manageable standards are. If we were to vacate and remand, isn't that what would happen? And the
yes.
District court would try to fashion the standards based on what was presented before it.
Yes, Your Honor, that's what we're asking for. We're asking for the opportunity to do that. You know, we have a situation where the political process is broken down. Beneficiaries of the Hawaiian Home Trust have not been given the money that they need to make the program work. And the position of the state and the Hawaiian Homelands is that the intent of the 1978 constitutional amendment is meaningless. It's devoid of any real substance and effect. That would further delay the promise made in 1959 when Hawaii became a state. It would further delay the promise made when the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act was enacted, and it would further delay the promise made at the time of the Mahele. It would deprive Hawaiians of being returned to their homelands, and we need the court's help so that we can get these issues litigated, and that's what we intend to do.
The question I asked you when you broke your train of thought is whether we should only consider general funds appropriations and not anything else. So I wanted you to at least finish that.
So it is fair to look at general obligation bonds, but you know, general obligation bonds are not for administrative and operating expenses. And there are four provisions in the state constitution that I cited to you. Now, let's say that the state was to provide $100 million in general obligation bonds to the Department of Hawaiian Homelands, which would be great, but they provided zero money for its administrative and operating expenses. Well, that would not be sufficient because they need monies to operate. They need money to administer their program, and you can't use CIP bonds, capital improvement bond money, to operate the department. So in that sense, yes, it is appropriate to look at those revenue sources, but you have to look at it with some specificity. So in this case, we know that Michael Connie said that the department needs $100 million a year to do its job. We know that it is getting a good chunk of money through Act 14 to remedy past breaches of the trust. That money is about to run out. And what the Department of Hawaiian Homelands wants to do is create revenues through leasing lands to replace that money. But that's not the way to go. The way to go is to the legislature to provide the funds the department needs to operate, to get that wait list down, to live up to the spirit and intent of the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act. Thank you.
Take this case under advisement.